Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Ben, bringing you this week's Sports Illustrated Magazine. In today's program, we're going to be covering a couple different sports articles, including some previews of the NBA Draft and WNBA Draft. Thank you again for listening. Let's get started. The first article I'll be covering is an essay called A Smashing Tell. A classic documentary about an MMA fighter gets a fictionalized makeover and plenty of star power by John Wertheim. True to its name, The Smashing Machine is an exercise in brutality, full of crashes, fights, and collisions leaving shards, both orthopedic and emotional. The 2002 documentary Tour de Force chronicles the rise and fall of Mark Kerr. DBA, the Smashing Machine, a hard on the outside, soft on the inside Ohio fighter. Now comes the scripted version. Dwayne Johnson, DBA, The Rock, plays Kerr in the film of the same name, which was released October 3rd, and entered the fray carrying the distinct whiff of Oscar nominations. The movie tells the story of Kerr, a hulking college wrestler who then launched a career in the punk rock sport of mixed martial arts. All was going, well, smashingly, until it wasn't, until we went from smasher to smashy. In an arresting early scene, Kerr sits in a doctor's waiting room, alongside other patients seeking bunion removals and strep throat swabs and the like. Kerr is seeing the doctor for another reason. He needs his face put back together. This, though, is no formulaic sports biopic. It's less rocky than Leaving Las Vegas, a journey of addiction, first with the adrenaline rush that comes with sanctioned violence. When you win, nothing else in the world matters, Kerr says early in the film, then a compulsion for pain pills. This is also a story of relationships, a doomed romantic one. A fraught dynamic with a mentor, Mark Coleman, who is also an early days MMA fighter. A personality reckoning with a sport that is both intoxicating and so damaging. Undergirding it all are two existential through lines. When your reason for being is to do something physical, what happens when your body stops cooperating? When you believe you are indomitable, what happens when you experience defeat? The Smashing Machine also doubles as a time machine. Set in the late 90s, Kerr's story exists before MMA and the UFC has penetrated the defenses of the mainstream. This was a pre-Dana White, pre-pay-per-view, much less cable, much less cards set at the White House and broadcast on CBS era, when a lack of rules and regulations was part of the outlaw appeal. And nothing could be said or written about the UFC without inevitably referencing John McCain's analogy to human cockfighting. MMA was sanctioned in only a few states, and fighters were better off heading to Japan, as Kerr and Coleman did, to participate in Pride Fighting Championships events. The first film directed solo by Benny Safdie, who usually tag teams with his brother Josh, in films including the insta-classic Uncut Gems. The Smashing Machine is faithful to the source material, the preceding doc, and the legacy of Kerr. In addition to Johnson, Emily Blunt co-stars as Kerr's complicated love interest. An assortment of familiar MMA fighters are featured as well, including former fighter Ryan Bader, who acquits himself well as Coleman. One sentence review, the film nails it. The large, but also the small details, such as the foggy walk losing fighters must make from the cage to the dressing room, and the genuine affection that passes between fighters who, minutes earlier, were beating the stuffing out of each other, and the omnipresence of pain. When the film premiered at the Venice Film Festival in September, where Safdie was named Best Director, the audience reacted as if seeing a brilliant knockout, all open mouth oohs and ahs and cheers during a prolonged standing ovation that left the principals in tears. For all the fine bits of filmmaking and poignant storytelling, this is ultimately a Dwayne Johnson star vehicle. Johnson holds on to Kerr's character and never lets go. Similar in body type and disposition, and born within a few years of each other, it's clear there was a kinship and connection between subject and portrayer. In addition to the innumerable sessions they spent together preparing for the film, Kerr, now 56, and Johnson, 53, sat down with Sports Illustrated for a no-holds-barred Q&A. For more, go to sportsillustrated.com. Start of the interview. Sports Illustrated. Why was this the right film at the right time? Dwayne Johnson. I felt like there was some real connective tissue with Mark's life and my own. Sure, today, but in the 90s, there were a lot of crossings in our worlds. There were a lot of pro wrestlers who then joined Pride. A lot of MMA guys came to wrestling, and I was always in awe of Mark. As the years went by, we both suffered a lot of losses. We lost a lot of friends to addiction and to suicide. There was a rash in both our businesses. In those late 90s, early 2000s, when I watched the Smashing Machine documentary years ago, I had just started acting. I felt then, God, I would love to play Mark Kerr. Cut to 2019, I buy the project. I lock the rights down. We connect with Mark, I speak to Mark, whom I had known 20 years earlier, and it all started to come together. And I met with Benny. We agreed to do it in 2019, and then COVID hit and shut everything down. Mark went his way, Benny went his way, I went my way, trying to figure life out. And years later, I realized how personal it was. I realized that I needed to tell this story because I have a profound respect for Mark and MMA and all the men and women who gave it up and leave it all in the cage or the ring. But in addition to that, I felt that I needed to break free and make this kind of film where I could dive deep and I could test and challenge myself. And I could get really raw and rip myself open with a co-star who I've known and been friends with for many, many years in Emily Blunt. Sports Illustrated. It was that personal? Dwayne Johnson. Yes, it's turned into more than a movie. It represents me, ready to break out of the infrastructure that has surrounded me for a long time. Making these big movies that I've loved, and they're fun, but I always felt there's a voice behind my ribcage telling me, there's more, right? There's more to do. Sports Illustrated. Mark, howdy do. Do you recognize yourself? Mark Kerr. So the first time I walked on set, we're in this arena in Vancouver, and they're getting ready to do the introduction for the Pride Grand Prix. Dwayne Johnson is the last one to come in the ring. Nobody tells me he's getting prosthetics. Nobody tells me they're going to do this cauliflower ear. I'm looking in the ring, and DJ's walking up behind me, and I turn around. All I could do is cuss at him. All I could do is just literally look at him and go, oh my God, dude, F you. It was this out-of-body experience. My son saw the film in New York. He's almost like whispering on the phone, Dad, he's got your hand movements, and he's got your speech pattern, and even walks like you. It was uncanny. Dwayne Johnson. I felt like I had to do this, and this was the great challenge of my life, of my career. This was a very physical transformation. This guy's body is crazy. In his prime, he was 270 to 275 pounds, just a unicorn of a body with fast twitch fibers. And Benny said, I don't know how to actually say this to you, but I think you're going to have to get bigger. That's when I went into a 12-week training camp with MMA coaches and fighters to help the transformation. And there was the vocal transformation. Liz Himmelstein was my vocal coach. She helped Emily on Oppenheimer. So she and I just studied Mark's speech pattern. Mark is this walking contradiction, a beast of a man, but also very soft-spoken, very caring. It was a lot to transform, but I loved every second. Sports Illustrated. How much weight did you end up putting on in total? DJ. Roughly 30 to 32 pounds, which is a lot of weight, but also I had to be able to move with that weight. Sports Illustrated. Mark, what specifically made you nervous before you fought? MK. Towards the end, I couldn't find that switch. When I first started fighting, I had to find something deep in me to flip a switch to inflict that much physical pain on somebody. In fighting, you have to have the ability to take something somebody doesn't want to give you, their will to win. I'm in the ring to inflict just enough pain and damage on you. I watched the film of myself walking down to the ring, and I couldn't recognize my facial expression and my demeanor. It was like this completely different personality and persona. I had to literally transform into a completely different person to get there, to inflict this much damage on a human being. I was like, I just can't do this anymore. DJ, from my vantage point, you realize that there's the machine and then there's the human being within the machine. And you also realize that it's not too dissimilar to our world of pro wrestling. And that's what I wanted to access with Mark. I wanted to make sure that my delts and my traps look like his. I felt moderately confident that we could nail the physicality part, but it's the emotional part that I wanted access to. Even in performative combat, like in pro wrestling, you've got the toughest of guys, but in the end, when it's done, it's done. And we have this custom where we hug and we say, thank you. I asked Mark about this. He would demolish these dudes, wreck them, but he'd also want to make sure that they were okay. Sports Illustrated. Mark, what other little details did the film get right? MK, even in pre-production, they're putting together all the set pieces and costumes. I'd walk into a room and it would just be screen grabs, pictures of me, pictures of my house, pictures of the clothes I wore. I could see why DJ completely got lost in the total immersion in that environment. I mean, they built four rooms in my house from 25 years ago. Sports Illustrated. DJ, what nuance struck you about MMA as you immersed yourself and really saw how the sausage gets made? DJ, the humanity of it. I've had the honor and privilege of being in performative combat where I can say to my opponent, take care of my arm tonight. Take care of my knee. I'll take care of your back. Let's get through the night. And let's not get hurt. Let's get home to our family. Let's pay our bills. With this kind of combat, you don't have that luxury, and your life is on the line. That really moved me. Sports Illustrated. I feel like there was a sub-theme in the film of fatherhood and lineage. I wonder if you guys bonded at all over your fathers, who I know both spent time on the road, and you guys are of a similar age. DJ, we bonded over everything, brother. MK, there's a lot of respect between us, man. So yes, if you want to call it a bromance, yes, it is.
The next article I'll be reading is Unusual Suspects, a new film is a postmortem on the demise of the Expos by Mark Bechtel. A new documentary on Netflix asks a simple question, one that's right there in the title. Who killed the Montreal Expos? The 90-minute film offers several suspects. The 1994 strike, which upended MLB's financial landscape, local politicians who refused to fund a new ballpark, dysfunctional team officials who couldn't stop bickering long enough to figure out how to get a stadium deal over the finish line. The most compelling person of interest, though, is David Sampson, the stepson of the former owner Jeffrey Loria, who ran the franchise for a short spell before Loria sold the team for a tidy profit and invested in the Marlins, clearing the way for the Expos to become the Washington Nationals in 2005. Sampson told Dan Lee Batard on a September podcast that he spent 9 hours talking to the producers last year before only finding out recently the name of the film. I had to call my agent, had to call my kids and say, I may have made a small mistake, Sampson said with a laugh. Sampson's Fox Pass is the movie's gain. He's easily the most entertaining thing in it. He's not exactly a perp in the box, he appears to be in his very nice living room, but his talking head segments are the closest thing we got to someone being grilled. It's not easy to choose scenery in a documentary, but Sampson does it to great effect. He seems to delight in being cast as the villain. I never met anyone who liked him, one journalist said in the film. and then shooting down any and all arguments that he was single-handedly responsible. And he makes very valid points. There's clearly plenty of blame to go around. If the doc doesn't deliver a smoking gun, it's still a fascinating TikTok of how teams are run. It also serves as a reminder of just how beloved the Expos were in a hockey-mad country. The sentiment is driven home in interviews with former players, such as Larry Walker and Pedro Martinez, from the Stack 1994 team that was a World Series favorite before the postseason was canceled. Fans and reporters also speak, as does the guy who played the team's mascot, Yopi. 30 years later, the actions of responsible parties, whoever they may be, clearly still resonate in Montreal. The next article I'll be reading is Feeling Cocky. For three seasons, Florida State's offense ran through guard Taniya Lotson, and the Seminoles were pretty good. But the nation's leading scorer in 2024-25 was in search of a bigger challenge. There was one obvious place to find it, South Carolina, by Michael Rosenberg. I knew they were outmatched, Derek says. I knew she was going to do what she had to do, but I just knew that it was probably going to be it. Taniya scored 30 points that day. Her team lost 101-71 anyway. 3 days later, she put her name in the transfer portal. 10 days after that, Connecticut ran Dawn Stanley's South Carolina team off the floor in the NCAA championship game, largely because the Huskies had more players who could create their own shots. Staley and Lotson were such an obvious match that even if they hadn't expressed interest in each other, a mutual friend would have tried to set them up on a blind date, which is kind of what happened. Gamecocks guard Raven Johnson played high school ball with Lotson in Georgia. Her pitch to Lotson? Let's go win a championship. Johnson did not have to explain why they could. In the last 4 years, the Gamecocks have won as many games in the Final Four, five, as they have lost in the months leading up to it. Over the last 6 seasons, they were 202-13 overall. Derek told his daughter, "You've got to get somewhere for you now." Taniya considered a few other schools in a lists are fun, so why not make one sort of way. But UConn was too far from home. While Tennessee has been reestablishing itself as a superpower, the Lady Vols lasted only one round longer than Florida State last year. She did not give herself a chance to fall in love with Texas or LSU. She didn't visit any schools, not even South Carolina. She just said this is where she wants to be, Staley says. It doesn't happen like that very often, for us or anybody else. It happens that way for people who have clarity on what they want. Now, South Carolina is the favorite to win the national title, which would be its fourth under Staley, who's entering her 18th season. Lotson could have kept rolling the dice at Florida State, or she could join the team with hotels on Boardwalk and Park Place. But she is seeking something besides a championship, something more subtle. She believes that by playing for a team that needs her less, she will be compelled to do more. Brooke Wyckoff did just about everything that a coach is supposed to do. As an assistant at Florida State, she built a relationship with Lotson early. Before every major power was recruiting her, Lotson became a top 20 recruit, but she chose the Seminoles largely because of their bond, and she stuck with her commitment after Wyckoff was promoted to head coach. Wyckoff put the ball in Lotson's hands as a freshman. She supported her and promoted her and challenged her. They made 3 straight NCAA tournaments together. Lotson left anyway. It was difficult, Lotson says. I love Florida State. That's my heart. When a transfer is considering her program, Staley always asks, "Why are you leaving?" "I want to make sure that I'm able to deliver on the reason why she's leaving," the coach says. Lotson easily could have said she wanted to win a national title and left it at that. She said she had a great situation there, Staley says. It was great, but she also knew that she would probably have to play the same role as she played for 3 years. A star on a pretty good team accumulates an unhealthy amount of power, and Lotson realized she did not always use hers wisely. "My first 2 years, I did not take the weight room seriously," Lotson says. "I just wanted to play." As for her defense, last year, it was really on me, Lotson says. Wyckoff did push me to play defense. She did. It was just knowing how much I could give. I took off reps on the defensive end. I had to hold myself accountable. Is it fair to say she occasionally coasted because she could get away with it? That's fair, Lotson says. But she was also stretched thin carrying the offense. I just needed a change after last year, to challenge myself, she says. Wyckoff declined a request to talk to Sports Illustrated for this story. There was a time when a player in Lotson's sneakers would put herself through a thorough self-examination entering her senior year. Ask some now-or-never questions. Commit to greatness. The leap is maturity from junior to senior year was an essential part to the collegiate athlete's journey. Now it's just one option among many. Last season, Lotson found herself watching South Carolina every chance she got. She told herself it was because the Gamecocks were one of the nation's best teams, or that she was keeping up with her friend, Raven. But in retrospect, she says, I was unconsciously looking at ways to grow my game. I knew what I wanted just by watching them. Once Lotson started thinking about leaving, it was hard to stop. Even in the best case scenario, Florida State will not be a better team than South Carolina. Wyckoff is not a better coach than Staley. She will not prepare Lotson better for the pros. FSU does not have more money, more support, or better training staff. Lotson had friends there, sure, but she had friends at South Carolina, too. The main reason to stay in Tallahassee was that she was already there, and even that was also a reason to leave. In a sense, her choice was not just between a top 25 program and a top 2 powerhouse. It was between another year of undergrad basketball in Hoops graduate school. Shortly after she arrived in Columbia, Lotson noticed something. See if you can spot what it is. Staley. We're going to need her production, but it's just different. Lotson. We lifted at FSU, but it's different in the SEC. Staley. Our program has produced pros. Not to say that Florida State doesn't, but it's just different. Derek Lotson, on his daughter's first few weeks in Columbia. She was exhausted. She said the work is totally different. Different sounded fantastic before Lotson experienced it. Then it, hit different. Although almost everything at South Carolina is better, because it is better, any moment can seem worse. The strength program's fabled Final Four Fridays produced aches now and championships later. Staley acknowledges that Lotson's transition wasn't smooth, but that didn't come as a surprise. Competitors are wired a little differently, Staley says. They anticipate having to go through some things, but they don't visualize bad days. So when it smacks them in the face, it doesn't feel good, right? But for me, I want to keep it smacking. When you can understand that this is what we're supposed to be going through right now, you can embrace it. There is a reason Staley has built a superpower in an era of constant upheaval. In a profession of control freaks, she maintains her poise. On the eve of South Carolina's Final Four matchup with Texas last spring, Staley said, I'm talking to parents. I'm talking to people in the transfer portal. I'm talking to agents. It's a lot. But if you're not someone that can easily pivot, this thing will swallow you up. While many coaches cling to their best players at the first sign of trouble, Staley employs a deeper rotation than any other top coach and sticks with it. She convinces players it is in their best interest to pass, to defend, and even to sit. Camila Cardoso did not start for the Gamecocks until she was a senior, at which point she became a second-team All-American. The NCAA tournament's most outstanding player, and the number 3 pick in the 2024 WNBA draft. Staley's players accept that she makes today harder so that tomorrow can be easier. She racks up wins by playing the long game. Always, Staley says. A lot of people don't understand that. The long game. The long game. When Lotson wobbled upon arrival, Staley just thought, better now than in February. I'm like, it's just June, Staley says. You gotta make her laugh about it because it's hard. This is her life. This is her career. She's putting it all into us. I'm not a panicker. The 5'8 Lotson is an explosive offensive player. One of Staley's comps for her is Allen Iverson. Players of her type, quick feet, good handle, always thinking they can get a bucket, tend to have the same flaws. They go for steals and potential fast breaks instead of playing sound team defense. They fire up low percentage shots because they haven't scored in a few possessions and they think it's their turn. Some players, like Iverson, carry those flaws all the way to the Hall of Fame. But the moment Lotson arrived at South Carolina, she was no longer a singular star. She was a player who was expected to meet the highest standard. Lotson said in September that, "My jumping has gotten a lot better. My overall body, my structure, I feel I'm a lot stronger." Staley has pushed her to defend with positioning, less hands, more body. Put your strong body in front of someone and have them bounce off of you. She mastered it. That last part is what has impressed Staley as much as anything. She picks up on things quickly, quickly, quickly. We're getting a seasoned senior. By the end of the summer, Lotson already looked like a better player than when she arrived. But she hadn't played any games yet, and those will be different too. In three seasons at Florida State, Lotson averaged 21.3, 21.4, and 25.2 points per game. But in the last decade, only two Gamecocks averaged more than 16 points per game for a season, and those two, Asia Wilson and Elijah Boston, were no argument number one WNBA draft picks. Funny thing about playing with stars like Chloe Kitts and Joyce Edwards, they want the ball too. Lotson is trying to improve on her passing, but the bigger challenge will be ignoring the box score. When Lotson entered the portal, she surely did not think, "I want to go help a team improve its spacing." But that is part of her job now. Sometimes she's going to have to allow defenses to not think about her so much, Staley says. Sometimes you gotta make them forget about you. Lotson must trust that the ball will come back her way eventually, because it will. Staley acknowledges that playing the long game is hard with T because it's the short game with her and us, but she's coming in with some things that naturally she does and naturally we don't have. In other words, T will get hers, just not as often as she did before. Lotson knows this can go poorly. Haley Van Lith was a superstar scoring guard at Louisville who transferred to LSU for a chance to play with more talent and become a better pro prospect. And it nearly broke her. After seeing her scoring average plummet to 11.6 points per game and her shooting percentage drop to 37.8%, Van Lith transferred again the next year to TCU, where the Big 12 player of the year had a career-high shooting percentage of 45.2%. There will be hard days, even when South Carolina wins, but Staley will remind Lotson, the long game. Playing Lotson ball for another 10 years was never a career option. Wilson, the Acres star and four-time league MVP, had the highest usage rate in the WNBA this regular season. She finished 30.7% of her team's possessions when she was on the floor. Lotson's usage rate at Florida State last season was more than 38%. She averaged more field goals, 19.5, and free throws, 7.8, last season than anybody in the WNBA this year. Win or lose, South Carolina will prepare Lotson for professional life. But who are we kidding? At South Carolina, it's win or win.
You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ben. Thanks again for listening.
The next article I'll be reading is Into Enemy Territory. For some college basketball transfers, a new team has an air of familiarity by Elizabeth Swinton. Sometimes a fresh start is just 94 feet away. When Olivia Miles' senior season at Notre Dame ended in the Sweet 16, she knew she was bound for something more. Whether it be in the WNBA, she was a projected lottery pick for the 2025 draft, or a different collegiate team. TCU, the team to which the Fighting Irish lost, was a group defined by its roster of transfers, such as Haley Van Lith, who were looking for a fresh start before going pro. That best fit, Miles thought, just happened to be with the squad that ended her season. "I'd been in a spot for 4.5 years. I have 2 degrees, says Miles, 22, who has a bachelor's in political science and a master's in nonprofit administration. I really completed everything that I wanted to do there, so I just wanted a clean start." As shocking of a decision as it was for the fans, Miles said she definitely did not anticipate her move would get so much attention. TCU provides a solid foundation for her graduate season. As second-team All-American, Miles has a real chance to go far with Mark Campbell's program, which took home the Big 12 championship and reached the Elite Eight last year. I just love to hoop, and whether it's one person watching me or 5 million, I really couldn't care less, Miles says. The joy of the game is enough for me. By the end of last season, nearly 1,500 Division I women's basketball players entered the transfer portal, so Miles wasn't the only one to take a spot on an opponent's roster. Shortly after Miles decided on her next step, another surprising name popped up in the portal: South Carolina guard Malaysia Fuwaili. Fresh off a championship game appearance, she made the decision to leave Columbia after two seasons for a familiar SEC foe, LSU. Fuwaili had dazzled offensively, 23 points off the bench in a Sweet 16 win over Maryland, but struggled to break through as a consistent presence on Coach Don Staley's roster, 11 minutes played in an Elite 8 win over Duke. The 5'10 junior, who went to high school just 10 miles from the Gamecocks practice facility, has made the move to Baton Rouge and will put her trust in LSU coach Kim Mulkey to untap her potential. It was the culture that Mulkey built with the Tigers that appealed to Fuwaili, not to mention how well she'd fit alongside players such as guard Flajay Johnson. I just want to show people that the little holes in my game don't define who I am, Fuwaili says. There will likely be some extra juice when Fuwaili matches up against her former team on February 14th, but moves like hers and Miles are becoming the norm in today's college basketball landscape. The result? Instant cinema. It's gonna be a movie, man, Fuwaili says. Y'all gotta stay tuned.
The next article I'll be reading is NBA Draft Preview. These prospects will be topping teams' big boards next June, by Kevin Sweeney. Number 1, Darren Peterson, Kansas. Bill Self calls the 6'6 Peterson the best freshman he has recruited at Kansas. The top American guard prospect since Cade Cunningham should be among the nation's top scorers this season. Number 2, AJ Dibonsta, Bayou. The 6'8 Dibonsta is the kind of big scoring wing every NBA team wants. At 18, he already has advanced offensive skills, and he'll fine-tune them under Cougars coach Kevin Young. Number 3, Cameron Boozer, Duke. The 6'9, son of former Duke great Carlos, may not have quite as high of a ceiling as Peterson or Dibonsta, but he'll be a double-double machine for the Blue Devils, and likely in the NBA, too. Number 4, Nate Ament, Tennessee. The 6'9 forward was a late bloomer who jumped up boards over the past year and a half. He still needs to put on weight, but long, agile wings with his shot-making ability are hard to find. Number 5, Michael Brown Jr., Louisville. The 6'3 point guard stock rose with his play for Team USA at the FIBA U19 World Cup this summer. The electric shooter and playmaker should be terrific in Coach Pat Kelsey's offense. Number 6, Jaden Quantens, Kentucky. The transfer power forward, 18, has game-changing defensive potential because of his length and shot blocking. He's coming off an ACL tear late last season at Arizona State. Number 7, Carmen Lopez, NZ Breakers. The 6'9 Lopez is a Mexican-born forward now moving the needle in the Australian NBL. He's impressed with his defensive mobility and his improved three-point shooting. Number 8, Tonde Yesofu, Baylor. Scouts love the 6'5 guard's upside on the defensive end and his scoring ability. The California boys' all-time prep scoring leader will look to be Baylor's 7th first-round pick since 2021. Number 9, Caleb Wilson, North Carolina. The 6'9 forward teamed up with Boozer in AAU and will now be his college rival at UNC. Wilson's athleticism is elite. If he can make threes consistently, he will climb draft boards. Number 10, Bennett Sturts, Iowa. The 6'4 senior guard's rise from Division II recruit to NBA prospect has been remarkable. He dominated at Drake last season and now follows coach Ben McCollum to the Big Ten.
Okay, for the next article, I'll be covering the WNBA draft preview. The Bruins and Huskies each have two players among the top prospects, by Kristen Nelson. Number 1, Lauren Betts, UCLA. The 6'7 center is the kind of sure thing around which franchises are built. Last season, she averaged 20.2 points on 64.8% shooting, 9.5 rebounds, and 2.9 blocks per game. Number 2, Ozzie Fudd, UConn. Her injury history, including multiple ACL tears, makes her a slight gamble, but the 5'11 guard's 43.6% shooting from 3 and smooth jump shot will be too enticing to pass up. Number 3, Olivia Miles, TCU. With 15.4 points and 5.8 assists at Notre Dame last season, coming off an ACL tear, the point guard, now at TCU, might have been the number 2 pick if she had entered the 2025 draft. Number 4, Tanaiju Lotson, South Carolina. The nation's leading scorer last year at Florida State transferred to a program that will elevate her profile and demonstrate just how the 5'8 guard fits in on an elite roster. Number 5, Flauje Johnson, ISU. The 5'10 guard has averaged double digits in each of her 3 seasons with the Tigers, including a career-high 18.6 points last year, and she is a potent rebounder as well. Number 6, Cody McMahon, Ole Miss. The 6-foot forward showed newfound 3-point range last year, 37.4%, at Ohio State. This year, in the SEC, her physicality will likely be the focal point of the Rebels' game plan. Number 7, Awa Pham, Valencia. The 6'4 Spaniard is just 19 years old and will likely be something of a project, but her combination of size and athleticism is rare enough that she can still help a team right away. Number 8, Sarah Williams, UConn. One of the top defensive bigs in the country, the 6'4 forward had 19.2 points, 9.8 rebounds, and 2.4 blocks per game last year for Wisconsin in a tough Big Ten. Number 9, Ashlawn Jackson, Duke. As the Blue Devils' primary perimeter weapon last year, the 6-foot guard tied a school record with 87 threes made while shooting 37.2% from beyond the arc. Number 10, Gianna Neipkins, UCLA. The career 43.2% three-point shooter transferred from Utah, where she averaged 19.3 points last season. Her efficiency should entice a W team in need of perimeter help. The next article I'll be reading is Games to Watch by Kevin Sweeney for men's college basketball. The first game is November 13th, Purdue at Alabama. The Boilermakers' season opener will be a big test for a squad that enters the year with title expectations, and it features a juicy point guard battle between Braden Smith and LeBaron Fillon. Even football-crazed Alabama fans will be zeroed in on this one. The next game is November 18th, Duke versus Kansas in New York City. Darren Peterson versus Cameron Boozer at Madison Square Garden? Sign us up. This year's Champions Classic gives us a monster matchup between the bluest of blue chip programs, each led by a prospect competing to be the number one pick in the 2026 NBA Draft. The next game is November 25th, Houston versus Tennessee in Las Vegas. This game is the crown jewel of the burgeoning Players Era Festival, an 18-team event in Las Vegas featuring many top players and programs. Seeing potential top 5 pick Nate Amendt take on the defense of the preseason number 1 Cougars should be fun. The next game is February 6th, UConn at St. John's. The teams both have elite rosters and polarizing coaches, and it will feel like an old-time prize fight when these Big East foes light up the arena on a Friday night. UConn will be out for payback after being swept by the Red Storm last season. The next game is March 7th, Florida at Kentucky. This looks to be Florida's toughest road game in SEC play, and it comes on the final day of the league's regular season, so it's possible that this meeting could decide the conference title. Last year's edition was a 106-100 barn burner won by the Wildcats. The next article I'll be covering is Games to Watch for Women's College Basketball by Kristen Nelson. The first game is November 26th, UCLA versus Texas in Las Vegas. A pair of last year's Final Four teams are looking to run it back. The Longhorns are led by backcourt duo of Madison Booker and Rory Harmon, while the Bruins added a second towering Betts, Lauren's younger sister, Sienna, to the fold. The next game is January 15th, Texas at South Carolina. The Gamecocks lost just one conference game last year, with the Longhorns snapping coach Don Staley's 57-game SEC regular season winning streak, but South Carolina took its revenge on Texas in the SEC tournament final and the Final Four. The next game is February 1st, Tennessee at UConn. The Lady Vols reignited this rivalry last February when they beat the Huskies for the first time since 2007, downing the eventual champs 80-76. Can Kim Cadwell's high-octane offense take down Gino Arima's squad 2 years in a row? The next game is February 14th, South Carolina at LSU. This matchup has become must-watch TV lately, but this year's added wrinkle, former Gamecock Milacia Fuwaili joins Flaje Johnson in purple and gold, makes it personal. One team's fans will experience heartbreak this Valentine's Day. The next game is February 15th, North Carolina at Duke. These Tobacco Road rivals met in Sweet 16 last March and delivered a low-scoring nail-biter in which Duke prevailed 47-38. As two of the ACC's top contenders this season, the Tar Heels and Blue Devils should deliver another gritty defensive battle. The next article I'll be reading is Getting an Early Start by Emma Basileri. The thriving unrivaled league is increasing its influence by connecting with players who are still in college. Flaje Johnson has always loved the vision board. "I get all the cutouts that I want," she says. "I'm like, this is what I want my life to look like." Now entering her senior season at LSU, preparing for professional hoops, Johnson has never had more choices of just what to cut out and paste onto her board. Her fellow top players may not all be planning their careers in quite the same way, but they're all sharing in the same feeling of possibility. They're watching as the WNBA rides a major growth wave and negotiates a new collective bargaining agreement. They're weighing the opportunity presented by Unrivaled, the 3-versus-3 league founded by WNBA players Nafisa Khalir and Brenna Stewart, which began play during the W offseason last January and has since announced expansion and a new round of investment to bring its valuation to $340 million. They're looking at how best to convert their NIL deals into ongoing professional sponsorships. In short, they're figuring out how they will navigate a world that did not exist when they entered college. The challenging futures of this group may be the best way to measure the growth of women's basketball. Most who entered college at the dawn of NIL in 2021 or 22 were made to believe that their spotlight and marketability would never be greater than it was under the NCAA. The professional futures that followed could be expected to involve low pay and limited choices, but that has changed enormously over the years they spent in college. The fact that players like Johnson have never before had these types of opportunities suggests that she has the right idea with her vision board. A 5-year plan is not useful in an environment where things change so quickly. Older pros can still be helpful resources, but their own careers don't exactly serve as useful examples. They never had these choices, and if any dream feels too lofty for the vision board now, Johnson's generation might only have to wait a few years. "You've got to create your own blueprint," says Johnson, who has been in national commercials for brands from Powerade to Samsung to Experian, and is also a rapper signed to Roc Nation. "There's no model. I feel like we're more so the model that people will follow." The contours of that shifting dynamic were captured most clearly over a weekend summit held this summer. More than a dozen of the best players in women's college basketball descended on the unrivaled league campus in Miami. Each had signed a deal that would have been difficult to explain just a few years ago. As the NCAA's definition of amateurism has shifted over the last decade, there is one part of the concept that has remained untouched, not to mention relatively unquestioned. College athletes can sign lots of contracts to be paid lots of money for lots of different activities, but they still cannot sign a contract with a pro sports league involving pay or promises of future pay, but for their athletic skill. In that last clause, however, Unrivaled saw an opportunity. A pro league cannot pay college basketball players to play basketball, but it could try paying them for being themselves. So this summer brought news that Unrivaled had signed NIL deals with 14 of the best players in NCAA women's basketball. There was no commitment for players to join the league. Instead, the deals centered on the weekend summit in August, when the players donned Unrivaled's merch, joined skill development sessions, participated in group bonding activities, and took photographs and filmed videos. It was familiar material for players used to handling sponsorship deals and brand activations. Except here, the brand in question was a league in which they might eventually play. It felt novel on several levels. Unrivaled had not existed when many of these players enrolled in college, and the notion that women's basketball might sustain another domestic league that was not just operational, but also attractive enough to investors and flush enough with cash to actively court players, that represented the biggest shift of all. We're in a unique position where we can have the connective tissue with college athletics and just build the rapport early with them, says Unrivaled General Manager Claire Duelius. That was kind of the focus for us as we reached out to different agents and players to see if they'd be interested in passing the baton to the next generation. Unrivaled leadership originally decided on a list of 14 college players to which it would extend these NIL offers. The hope was to get 10 to say yes, all 14 did. Many of the players described the deal as obvious for them. They know they have choices right now, and they want to keep them open. It's unbelievable the amount of things that you can do now, says UCLA All-American Senior Center Lauren Betts. That's strikingly different from the careers these players had imagined for themselves as girls. Growing up, I always talked about wanting to play in the W, Bet says. And I remember my parents telling me, well, you can hope that you can play in the W forever, but you have to make a living as well, and you might have to go play overseas. That had always been the standard in women's basketball. Players made as much as 10 or 15 times a WNBA salary playing during the winter in countries like Russia, Turkey, and China. It has been just a decade since Diana Taurasi's Russian team paid her $1.5 million to sit out the WNBA season and play exclusively overseas. A nearly impossible figure to refuse when her WNBA salary was just under what was the league maximum of $107,000. The professional hoops aspirations of an entire generation were shaped by stories like that one. But the best college players today find themselves with a very different outlook. The WNBA maximum salary is now $250,000 and is set to increase significantly again. The current CBA was set to end on October 31st. Negotiations on a new agreement are framed by the 11-year, $2.2 billion media rights deal the league signed in July 2024. Unrivaled was founded partially to relieve the strain that players experience going overseas every winter. It offers a shorter season that starts later and finishes earlier than most international leagues, giving players a longer break without the stress of overseas travel. And for its first year, Unrivaled paid an average salary of roughly $220,000, more than double the WNBA's average. Paige Buchers, the W's 2025 number one pick, signed an early version of an Unrivaled NIL deal, giving her equity in the league while she was still in college. Upon turning pro, she signed a 3-year deal to play in Unrivaled, where she will earn more in her first year than in all 4 seasons of her WNBA rookie contract. Johnson signed a similar equity deal last December. If players long felt like they scarcely had one viable pathway to a career, they now feel like they have the freedom to pick from different options in charting their own. You can't really look at people ahead of you because it was a little different for them, says UConn graduate student guard Ozzie Fudd. But you're always being grateful for them and giving them their flowers and thanking them whenever you can, because without them, none of this would be possible for us. There is freedom in choice. Players can afford to be more selective about the opportunities they pursue and the deals they make. By the time they turn pro, they have spent years navigating brand deals, getting more comfortable asserting themselves, and figuring out how to build the kind of careers they want. Everything's a learning opportunity, Fudd says after taking part in an unrivaled photo op. So if something happened in this shoot that I didn't like, okay, cool. Next time I know what to ask for. I know what not to ask for. And they do not feel quite so constrained by time pressure as some of their predecessors did. The message in women's basketball had been, there will never be a platform for you as big as the one you will have in college. A stronger audience for pro hoops and more lucrative opportunities to go along with them have changed that dynamic. It's not just the years in college that we have to make money, says UCLA senior guard Kiki Rice. It's after that. And I think that's what we all feel like we deserve. Their careers have already looked different than any that came before them. And they're just fine with that, says Johnson with a grin. I always say I was born at the right time. I'll be finishing today's program with an article from ESPN.com, NHL All-Time Goalie Wins, Top 10 Players to Know, by ESPN staff. While there's a lot of talk about the most unbreakable records in sports, one all-time mark that deserves more attention is Martin Brodeur's 691 career wins, the most by a goalie in NHL history. Even if a player can match Brodeur's longevity and durability, today's NHL teams opt to rest their goalies and limit their starts. It seems unlikely that a modern goaltender will be able to rack up enough wins to seriously challenge Brodeur. How big is the gap between Brodeur and the active leader? Who else cracks the top 10 in career wins? Let's look at which goalies have recorded the most wins in NHL history. Number 10, Sergei Bobrovsky, 436 wins. Bobrovsky is a two-time Vezina Trophy and Stanley Cup winner. His save percentage of .931 led the league in 2016-17 as a member of the Columbus Blue Jackets. He's also played for the Philadelphia Flyers and Florida Panthers. Number 9, Jacques Plante, 437 wins. Plante played off and on from 1947 to 1975, including stints with the Montreal Canadiens, New York Rangers, St. Louis Blues, Toronto Maple Leafs, Boston Bruins, and Edmonton Oilers. He helped the Canadiens win the Stanley Cup 6 times, including 5 straight years. Plante won the Hart Trophy as the league's most valuable player in 1962, and he racked up an NHL record 7 Vezina trophies. Plante is also known for inventing and popularizing the goaltender mask. He was inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame in 1978. Number 8, Terry Sawchuk, 445 wins. Sawchuk was an 11-time All-Star who played from 1949 to 1970, winning 4 Stanley Cups in his career. He was a 4-time Vezina Trophy winner and became the first goalie to record 100 career regular season shutouts. To this day, Sawchuk has the second most shutouts in NHL history, 103, trailing only Martin Brodeur, 125. The Detroit Red Wings retired Sawchuk's number 1 in 1994, and he was inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame in 1971. Number 7, Curtis Joseph, 454 wins. Despite going undrafted, Curtis Cujo Joseph became a star goalie, playing for the St. Louis Blues, Edmonton Oilers, Toronto Maple Leafs, Detroit Red Wings, Phoenix Coyotes, and Calgary Flames. Joseph excelled with multiple teams, becoming the first goalie in NHL history to have a 30-win season with 5 different teams. Joseph became a 3-time All-Star. While he never played in the Stanley Cup Final, he had an outstanding career. Number 6, Henrik Lundqvist, 459 wins. Lundqvist spent the entirety of his 20-year NHL career with the New York Rangers. He's the only goaltender in NHL history to start his career with 7 straight 30-win seasons. He was incredibly consistent, winning at least 20 games in each of his first 11 seasons. Lundqvist won the Vezina Trophy for Best NHL Goaltender in 2012. He was inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame last year. Number 5, Ed Belfour, 484 wins. After going undrafted, Belfour played for 19 seasons with the Chicago Blackhawks, San Jose Sharks, Dallas Stars, Toronto Maple Leafs, and Florida Panthers. He won the Stanley Cup in 1999, earned Vezina trophies in 1991 and 1993, and took home the Roger Crozier Saving Grace Award in 2000, which is given to the goalie with the best save percentage. He was selected to 6 All-Star games and was enshrined in the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2011. Number 4, Roberto Luongo, 489 wins. Throughout his 19-year NHL career, Luongo played for the New York Islanders, Florida Panthers, and Vancouver Canucks. He was the number 4 overall pick in the 1997 NHL draft, eventually becoming a 6-time All-Star. In 2007, he was a finalist for the Hart Trophy, MVP. Among all goalies throughout NHL history, Luongo played the second most games, 1,044, and recorded the second most saves, 28,409, trailing only Martin Brodeur in both stats, 1,266 and 28,928, respectively. Luongo was inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2022. Number 3, Patrick Roy, 551 wins. Roy was the number 51 pick in the 1984 NHL draft, and he would suit up for the Montreal Canadiens and Colorado Avalanche. When Roy retired in 2003, he was the winningest goalie of all time, but the top two goaltenders of the list would later pass him. To this day, Roy still leads all goaltenders in playoff wins, 151. Roy won 4 Stanley Cups, 3 Vezina trophies, and 3 Conn Smythe trophies, a team MVP award. He was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2006, and he's currently the head coach of the New York Islanders. Number 2, Marc-Andre Fleury, 575 wins. Fleury finished off his career with the Minnesota Wild in the 2024-25 season. In addition to the Wild, Fleury has also suited up for the Pittsburgh Penguins, Vegas Golden Knights, and Chicago Blackhawks. The number 1 overall pick in the 2003 draft, Fleury lived up to the hype. The 5-time All-Star has won 3 Stanley Cups and a Vezina Trophy in 2021. Number 1, Martin Brodeur, 691 wins. In addition to having the most wins in NHL history, Brodeur also holds record for the most shutouts, 125, and games played, 1,266, throughout his 22-year NHL career. The 9-time All-Star won 3 Stanley Cup championships, 1995, 2000, and 2003, and 4 Vezina trophies, 2003, 2004, 2007, and 2008. Brodeur was nominated for the Hart Trophy MVP 3 times in 2003, 2004, and 2007. For 12 consecutive seasons, he won at least 30 games, and he had 8 seasons with 40 wins. Brodeur was selected to the NHL's 100 Greatest Players list and in 2018 was inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame. That's all we have time for this Sun Sounds of Arizona program. Thanks again for listening. This is your volunteer reader, Ben.